From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on January 28, 2005. World leaders gathered in Poland to mark the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And many nations sent their top leaders to the event. Their premiers, their presidents, France sent Jacques Chirac, Russia sent Vladimir Putin, the United States sent Vice President Dick Cheney. It was a cold day, and just about every world leader was dressed in a dark formal overcoat, as noted by Washington Post fashion editor Robin Givhan. But not Dick Cheney that day. Givhan wrote that Cheney was, quote, dressed in the kind of attire one typically wears to operate a snowblower, end quote. But that wasn't all. Givhan was not simply taking a shot at Cheney's shoddy clothing that day. She was remarking about what she perceived as a show of disrespect. And I'm going to read more from that piece now. Quote, like other attendees, the vice president was wearing a hat, but it was not a fedora or a Stetson or a fur hat or any kind of hat that one might wear to a memorial service as a representative of one's country. Instead, it was a knit ski cap embroidered with the words Staff 2001. It was the kind of hat a conventioneer might find in a goodie bag. His wife, Lynn, was seated next to him. Her coat has a hood, too, and it is essentially a parka, but it is black and did not appear to be functioning as either a name tag or a billboard. One wonders if at some point the vice president turned to his wife, took in her attire, and asked himself why they seemed to be dressed for two entirely different events. Some might argue that Cheney was the only attendee with the smarts to dress for the cold and snowy weather, but sometimes, out of respect for the occasion, one must endure a little discomfort. Now, there is little doubt that intellectually, Cheney approached the Auschwitz ceremony with thoughtfulness and respect. But symbolism is powerful. The vice president might have been warm in his parka, ski cap, and hiking boots, but they had the unfortunate effect of suggesting that he was more concerned with his own comfort than the reason for braving the cold at all. End quote. Robin Givhan would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize, not just for this piece, but also for her work in turning fashion criticism into cultural criticism. She's the only one to win the Pulitzer for fashion writing. Tomorrow, she's coming to Syracuse University for a public event. We'll tell you about that coming up. But first, we asked her to join us on Connections to discuss her work, changing fashion norms, and I was surprised how much I feel like we could go all day with her. But Robin Givhan is joining us from The Washington Post. Robin, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
And Eric,
pleasure.
Oh, very good. Eric Grody is with us in studio. He's the director of the Gold Ring Arts Journalism Program at Syracuse University. Eric's been on the program before for a number of reasons, but we were just talking before this program began about why you wanted Robin Givhan to come join us tomorrow night. So why did you set this up here, Eric?
One of the classes I teach each year as part of the program is called the Literature of Arts Criticism, and part of it is different students get their own presentations ready of writers, editors, could be from the past, present, who they think are really influential, compelling, great arts writers. And two or three years in a row, people started presenting Robin Givhan, whose name I knew, but I'm not a terribly fashionable guy and haven't traditionally read a whole lot about fashion. And so I kind of glommed onto her via them and was just blown away at the quality of the writing and thought she would be a fantastic person to have up at the program.
The winner of the Pulitzer Prize. And Robin, did you agree with the committee when they said one of the reasons they wanted to give you that award was that your work was, yes, it's fashion criticism, but it's cultural criticism. And I started the program with the piece on Dick Cheney because I felt like that's exactly what it was. Do you agree with that?
I think one of the really nice things about my career is that the vast majority of it has been at the Washington Post, where fashion doesn't appear in a separate section. It appears in the style section, which covers so many topics. And I think has sort of forced me to try to reach as broad an audience as possible and to try very hard to avoid sort of preaching to the choir about strictly hemlines and color trends and things that typically would appeal to someone who is already an avowed fashion fan.
Sure. And I think it's important to point out as well that in the piece on Dick Cheney that I read from, Robin included the fact that at the inauguration, it had been very cold, and Dick Cheney was dressed much more like the other foreign leaders and dignitaries who were commemorating the liberation of Auschwitz. So he's certainly capable of braving the cold in more classy attire. So, Robin, when you saw what he was wearing that day, was it just too easy? Was that like an easy mark for you?
It was. was a bit astonishing because it was so, the photograph was so incredibly striking. A colleague from our photo staff had actually sent it to me because it was so jarring to her. And, the other little piece of that was that particular ceremony was filled with all kinds of symbolism. I mean, one of the things that they included was the sound of train whistles and searchlights, sort of recalling the horrors at Auschwitz. And so, it was such a symbolic occasion that it seemed to me that the clothing was even more important because, it really was trying to tell a story through impressions, through sights and sounds.
Talking to Robin Givhan, who is a critic and fashion editor for The Washington Post. She is coming tomorrow to Syracuse University, the Joyce Hergenhan Auditorium, 5:30 p.m. And Eric Rohde, that's open to the public?
Oh, yes. Anyone's more than welcome to come.
And there's so much to talk about. In fact, Robin, I hope we can get to the Battle of Versailles, your book. I've got some questions about that. But I want to stick with some of the most recent news events. Since the changing at the White House, obviously there's a new family in there. We'll get to the Trump family in just a moment. But in a recent piece you wrote, kind of looking back at the legacy of Michelle Obama, you included the fact that there are those who are already saying, this is the end of an era. That you wrote that designer Derek Lam was having a conversation and kind of dropped his head in a mournful manner and said, Michelle Obama leaving the East Wing signals the end of a singular era for American fashion. Is that too strong, or you think it really is the end of an era?
I think it is certainly the end of a quite long chapter and quite an influential chapter as well. There had been first ladies prior to Michelle Obama who had worn designer clothing, who had expressed or at least shown an interest in fashion, in designer style, but she was really the first one who used it in such a nuanced way to further her message. She was, very focused on this combination of high and low fashion, sort of expensive and relatively inexpensive fashion, so that the average woman could actually go out and buy the things that she was wearing. But she also, I think, was very striking because of her generation, because she was this sort of post-Title IX woman who was very much part of, a sportier, more physically fit generation of women who expressed femininity in a way that was very different from their predecessors, who expressed femininity in terms of, strength and muscles and, the ability to, run a 10-minute mile.
Well, and you also have noted something, I think, for me, strange about the last 8 years. In several places throughout the years, you've noted the weird fascination this country has had with Michelle Obama's arms. And first of all, I think you're right to point out that Michelle Obama has been a model of middle-age fitness. I mean, I think she has been pure class. And her critics, often right-wing critics, seem to take every chance they could get to sort of freak out at the sight of her bare arms. And now, of course, by the way, we hear nothing from them about Melania Trump, who has bared a lot more than her arms. But does that kind of partisanship get tiresome to you, or was there ever anything legitimate in there?
Well, I mean, I don't think you could ever fully extricate the sort of partisan political aspect from the conversation. But, I think it was particular to Michelle Obama because, she wasn't just bearing sort of long, thin, delicate arms. She was bearing arms that were sculpted. And, that kind of strength was striking. You couple that with the fact that she was African American, and there are such complex, disconcerting opinions that people have about black female bodies and what they represent and whether or not they can be viewed as representative of womanhood. And then there's also the aspect of, as a lot of women know, you know, getting arms like that, you know, requires work and dedication. And there is an element of just sort of personal time spent working to achieve a physique like that, that some people might read as selfish or narcissistic or self-absorbed, and others see as purely, you know, personal maintenance and, you know, and personal pride. So I think there were a lot of things sort of wrapped up in her arms. Sad as it is.
Eric?
And if I could just interject for a minute, one of Robin's more recent pieces, which jumping off from Melania's portrait, the one that recently came out, talked about Melania's body language, contrasted with Michelle's body language, contrasted with Laura Bush's. Laura and Melania both had their arms crossed, which shows a form of strength or power in a way, contrasted with Michelle in the middle. It also showed how tight the close-up was of, you know, Melania's face and upper body compared to the other two. The other two were much farther back, and Laura Bush had, not so coincidentally, a Mary Cassatt painting of a mother with two small children in the background that was very clearly visible. And so one of the things I love about Robin's writing is talking about, yes, what clothes each of the women are wearing, but also their environment and the fact that all of these things you put on your body or take off your body are choices you make and what those choices say about the version of you you want to put in the world.
Sure, and I'm going to be asking about how she views this administration in just a moment here. But I also have to point out to listeners that as much as Robin Givhan throughout the tenure of the Obamas in the White House had a lot to say about Michelle Obama's legacy, the example she set, a lot of it, I would say, was praise. In 2009, you took the First Lady to task for wearing shorts when coming off of Air Force One for his vacation. And so let me read what you wrote then, and then I can't wait to hear the kind of response you got. You wrote this, quote, "Ultimately, the First Lady can't be, nor should she be, just like everyone else. Hers is a life of responsibilities and privileges. She gets the fancy jet. She has to dress for the ride, or at least that's as it should be. The reality is that a good portion of the culture has become loudly vocal about how clothes don't matter and how it's snobbish or shallow to suggest that they do. But clothes are part of our broader aesthetic obligation to each other. That commitment pushes homeowners to mow their lawns and not be a blight to their neighborhood. And in the White House, the aesthetic demands are higher than they are on Main Street. Avoiding the appearance of queenly behavior is politically wise, but it does American culture no favors if a First Lady tries so hard to be average that she winds up looking common," end quote. Now, I'm sure you heard some feedback from readers saying, way too far, let her wear shorts. You know, who are we to tell her she can't wear shorts? What kind of feedback did you get on that?
Oh, just a smidge. you're absolutely right. I mean, there were people who were definitely outraged, and there is always that contingent that really makes the argument that the clothes should not matter at all. And, you know, my response to them is that clothes, of course, matter because it's why, you know, we wear black to a funeral. It's why, you know, there's this whole conversation about trying not to upstage a bride at a wedding. It's why there are interview suits and all these pieces of clothing that are for very particular occasions. And in that case, yes, she was on vacation. But the reality is that when you're the First Lady, you're never on vacation. And I mean, and I do think that the First Lady has a somewhat more challenging role than the President in the sense that the President is public all the time. The First Lady sort of operates in this gray area during which there are occasions when she is private and there are occasions when she's clearly public, and then there's this sort of middle ground. And this was, I think, in her mind, a private occasion, but she was stepping off of Air Force One, and there were military men and women at the foot of that aircraft, and there was a press pool assembled to take her photograph. So this was clearly a public moment. And at that point, she is not representing herself on vacation. She is occupying the role of First Lady, and she is representing us all.
So what was the bigger scandal, that moment with Michelle Obama wearing shorts or Barack Obama wearing an earth-tone suit to a news conference?
Well, I think the earth-tone suit practically broke some people's Twitter feed.
Yes,
because,
I think so.
People went a little bit bonkers on that. But in my mind, it was more of a culturally concerning moment when Michelle Obama wore the shorts.
Okay.
I think it was more of a sort of politically jarring moment when Barack Obama wore a tan suit.
But was that a mistake, by the way, the tan suit? I mean, it's a strange question, but you know, does that convey a different sort of tone? Does it matter? Should we care?
I don't think it was necessarily a mistake, but I do think it says something about our perceptions of what, you know, leadership looks like and sort of the uniform of leadership. And there was definitely this feeling that somehow this lighter colored, slightly less, you know, formal suit was in some way this dilution of what it meant to look presidential. You know, I think had we been, you know, looking at a Hillary Clinton administration right now, we would be having this question, we'd be raising this question constantly, because there was really, you know, there was no template for what a female commander-in-chief looked like on so many different occasions. I think we would, people's Twitter feed would be in a constant state of meltdown practically every time she walked out.
Yeah, and, you know, this is where, to the extent that, you know, you have your own critics, the people who, as you noted in that piece about Michelle Obama and the shorts, say, what's the big deal? Why are we focusing on fashion? It's unfair. You know, I know that there are some who say this kind of criticism is always tilted unfairly against women, that women are judged much more harshly than men. There's that story that's famous by now of the Australian news anchor who basically didn't change his suit for a year and no one noticed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wonder if you generally agree with that, if you feel that whether it's a first lady or a woman who is a senator or potentially a commander in chief, are we overly fixated? I mean, where do we draw the line on where fashion criticism is good for the culture to help understand messages, respect, et cetera, and where is it unfair to women? Where is it unfair in general?
I think it's, you know, unfair when we start talking about, you know, people's sort of person. And by that I mean, you know, someone's weight or the size of their nose or the, you know, the shape of their legs or their height. You know, my feeling is always the aspects of appearance that I focus on are those that people make a conscious decision about. And, you know, I would argue that we should spend more time considering male attire to sort of even things out. But I mean, I think also one of the reasons why there's so much more written about women's appearance, particularly with their clothes, is because they have such a bigger range of choices than men have. And I think within those choices, they also have a richness of tools to use to communicate if they choose to use them. I think men certainly are more limited in what they can sort of say and communicate with their clothes. But I don't think that simply because we consider what women are wearing means that we're necessarily being unfair to them. I think we are sometimes being remiss in not caring more about what men wear.
Okay, Eric?
If I can actually just request that this public scrutiny on men's attire we hold off on until Wednesday. I'm actually sharing the stage with Robin on tomorrow night at Syracuse. And I have put more thought, probably the last 200 outfits I've put on combined have
Seriously,
taken less
what
thought.
In the world can you wear with the Washington Post fashion editor?
So I have notes here, and I have tan suit with a big line through it. Like, I know...
I am so not that judgmental.
No. See, here's the thing. We I don't think Eric would assume you're judgmental, but he's going to get in his own head about this. And tan suit, if you didn't know going in, well, you might be able to pull it off.
No.
No?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, you probably don't own a tan suit, though, do you?
I'm not about to go buy one today.
Okay. Tomorrow night, 5:30. Where is it, Eric Grody?
At Syracuse University, the Joyce Hergenhan Auditorium, which is in the Newhouse Building.
Robin, you mentioned Michelle Obama, her legacy being sort of a multifaceted one for a lot of different reasons in American culture. And just reading your work and talking to you today and understanding, I think, what you've written in total about Michelle Obama, I focused on the shorts piece. But for the most part, I think the legacy is a pretty remarkable one. And you mentioned how a lot of the time she would wear something that, you know, sort of the proletariat might think that's pretty accessible, that we might be able to go get. How important is it to you that whether it's Michelle Obama, Melania Trump, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, whoever it is, mm-hmm. is wearing something that is accessible as opposed to, you know, the 1% of the 1% of the 1% can afford this?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that people need to understand is that the First Lady does not get a wardrobe allowance. Laura Bush sort of famously commented that when she came into the White House as First Lady, she was stunned by the amount of designer clothing she was, you know, quote unquote, expected to purchase. And there is this expectation that, you know, they're not repeating outfits, which, you know, is kind of crazy. So, you know, my feeling is I think every First Lady should dress in a way that expresses who she is. And for someone like Michelle Obama, who came from a modest background, who was at one point a working, you know, a professional, an attorney, you know, I think her wardrobe reflected that. And that what made it so striking to many people was how contemporary it was. Before that, it often seemed that first ladies were sort of dressing from this quote-unquote first lady closet, where everything was a relatively boxy suit and sensible heels and a ball gown, you know, came with a fitted bodice and a full skirt, and that was it. And, you know, it was a momentous occasion, you know, when they wore trousers. I mean, when Hillary Clinton, you know, started wearing pants, and when Laura Bush, started wearing pantsuits, she commented that she would get letters from people who didn't think that the First Lady should wear pants. So for Michelle Obama, that sense of, being contemporary was incredibly striking. I think with Melania Trump, I mean, she's a very different kind of First Lady, a very different background, a very different budget. So it would be, I think, odd for people, to see her wearing, you know, dresses from The Gap. So I don't think people necessarily want what they say they do, which is, to have a First Lady turn up at a state dinner in a dress that they picked up off the rack from the local mall for $100. They claim that they want that. I suspect that if that's what a First Lady wore, there would be blowback.
Would there be blowback from you, though?
I think it would. To me, I'm less interested in whether or not I think a dress is pretty or particularly attractive, as I am in, you know, the resonance of that choice and how it fits into an occasion. What it symbolizes in that moment and in that context. There have been many instances when people have said, what did you think of a dress that, you know, Michelle Obama wore? And my feeling is, you know, the aesthetics of it is very subjective. You know, some people like red, some people don't. I really hate teal. So pretty much anything that's teal, I'm personally just not going to like. But that's not what I think is particularly interesting. To me, it becomes more about who is the designer of that dress? Who is the manufacturer of that dress? What does that dress say about the occasion and the person's relationship to that occasion? What does the dress, you know, symbolize in a broader context?
How do you feel about Melania Trump so far in terms of some of her choices?
I think that her choices have been extremely reserved, and in many ways quite conservative for someone whose background comes out of the fashion industry. You know, her choices have not been particularly, quote-unquote, you know, sort of fashion-forward. She's not wearing things that, you know, you would argue are sort of on the cutting edge of fashion. I think that her style has been very streamlined, and in some ways, it I think speaks to an Upper East Side existence. But in another, I think it's another way. I think it's very cautious. It's very, I think, aware of history, and I think it's also very self-conscious in the sense that it seems to be chosen because of the knowledge of all of those eyes trained directly on her.
Sure. Whereas her husband plays golf every weekend in pants from Rumpled R Us. You know, I mean, it's like he's in a contest to see how many pleats he can put in his pants, and nothing looks like it fits, though I'm not sure form fitting is what we should be going for. But I don't, you know, how do you feel about what he's wearing around at Mar-a-Lago, especially when he's playing golf?
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by his attire just in general because, you know, going from the suits all the way, you know, to the, you know, what he wears on the golf course, none of it's particularly well-fitting, but it's not cheap either. I mean, these are expensive suits of quality fabric, but they're worn in a way that makes them look a bit sloppy and a bit lowbrow. And to me, I think it is a reflection of someone whose, you know, self-proclaimed wealth puts him in one category, but there's the clothing also sort of indicates that he may be wealthy, but he is not of the wealthy. I mean, he doesn't dress like someone who is... who is focused on, you know, looking expensive.
Yeah, and don't worry, listeners, we could do this in a bipartisan way. We could talk about Obama and mom jeans or whatever. But, you know, so the bottom line is there are all kinds of interesting choices, and we're talking to Robin Givhan, who is the fashion editor for The Washington Post. She's the only one to win the Pulitzer Prize for fashion writing, and the Pulitzer Committee said that that was because her work transcends just fashion and is really cultural criticism. She's coming tomorrow to Syracuse University to the Joyce Hergenhan Auditorium for a 5:30 p.m. presentation. It's free, open to the public, and you can attend if you'd like. What I want to do is I want to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls. Rick in Rochester will come to you. Any listeners want to weigh in here, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. Eric Grody wants to know what he should wear tomorrow, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's our only break of the hour, and we continue with Robin next. Coming up in our second hour, teaching climate change in the classroom. New York State has new standards coming up here on July 1st. We'll take a look at that. We'll also look at how science is taught and how climate is taught in various places, from Portland to West Virginia, some classrooms where it's still taught as a controversy. We'll take a look at all of what goes into making sure kids are raised with climate literacy. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get a little audience feedback first. This is Rick in Rochester. Go ahead, Rick.
Good afternoon. Robin, I was wondering when you said that Twitter explodes. What for the vast majority of people, what gender is that? I'm just curious, because personally I find this very irrelevant, except for, you know, Cheney showing up in a parka and snow boots that look like he's ready to snowball the driveway, but that's Cheney. And what does Trump say about what's this boy there, Bannon?
Steve Bannon, yes.
Yeah, he dresses like he just got out of a wet sack as well. I mean, what's going on, this has no bearing to me. This has absolutely no bearing.
All right, Rick, thank you for that. And Robin, that's not the first time you've heard someone say, we should be focused on what's happening in the world, not what people are wearing. So what's the response to that?
Well, I mean, I think that we can hold multiple thoughts in our head simultaneously. I mean, I don't think that simply because, you know, we're considering what someone is wearing and how they're presenting themselves and how they're attempting to use their appearance to connect with people, to that doesn't negate also, you know, listening to what they're saying and considering the policy that's coming out of the White House or, you know, Capitol Hill or wherever. So, I mean, it seems like it's an argument that's a little bit of a non-argument. And that said, you know, I always sort of raise the question of, you know, if you are, you know, burying a loved one and someone shows up at that funeral wearing, you know, a clown suit, you might be happy that they made the effort to attend, but I think you'd also be disturbed by or distracted or concerned by what they chose to wear under those circumstances because it suggests a certain disrespect. You know, and I think also attire is something that, particularly in the realm of politics, is something that's used regularly to try and form this kind of instant connection with people. You know, it's the reason why so many politicians, when they go to a union hall, that, you know, their immediate reaction is to remove their suit jacket and to roll up their sleeves. And I sort of describe it as sort of the universal political symbol of, I'm about to speak earnestly now. And, you know, it's the same kinds of things happen, you know, throughout campaigns. I mean, I think it is notable that one of the primary ways in which, you know, Trump got his message across was with a red baseball cap with, you know, a logo on it. And, you know, I think that is was a telling choice. It was not a T-shirt. It was not, you know, just a campaign button. But it was, you know, a baseball cap that sort of conjures up all of that sort of Americana, sort of team player, we're all in this together kind of notions. So to say that it doesn't matter, I think, is to deny something that is part of, you know, the way in which we communicate, which is visually.
Let me ask Eric Grody if I could, just because Eric's the director of the Goldring Arts Journalism Program at Syracuse University and made the decision to reach out to Robin and bring her in for tomorrow's event. And one of the things that Eric said to me was, number one, you know, this may not be your realm, fashion, but she's a fabulous writer and a very interesting thinker when it comes to culture. So tell me a little bit more about your thoughts on that, Eric.
Well, yeah, I mean, arts journalism is the program at Syracuse, and people have certain assumptions about whether that includes, first, I think maybe people might just think it was theater and opera or ballet, or, you know, does that also extend out to film and television? Yes, it does. Does it, where does it go from there? And quick shout out to Robin's book, The Battle of Versailles, which is a fascinating book about this 1973 competition in France between friendly competition between American designers and French designers. And in the preamble to the competition, Robin talks about how fashion had to argue for its place at the table in a way that some of these other art forms haven't necessarily had to. But she's a writer who does, if she was just writing about the runway shows and the hemlines to, you know, and the color trends, to use her phrase, I would probably be able to recognize that it was, you know, quality craftsmanship and good sentences in a row. But that's not what she does. I mean, she really connects the dots and helps explain why this stuff matters, not just to the people who already care about that stuff, but people who don't yet care about fashion because they don't quite yet grasp where this fashion discussion can take you. And I think that's a really useful thing for me and for everyone.
All right, a couple of quick listener questions for Robin. One of them comes from Wendy in the city. She says, I have an anthropologist friend who collects headgear from around the world. In our avoidance of monarchical crowns, Has the authority of the American presidency been hampered by the lack of an identifiable headgear that projects authority, or is it an asset that a president dresses like his or her American peers? Robin?
You know, it's funny that that would be the question, because I was actually just sort of thinking about the way in which the business suit is this kind of uniform of authority. And I recall during the early days of the Affordable Care Act debates, you'd have these town halls, and the images were so striking because so often you would have the citizens standing and sort of yelling at their representatives, and they would be there, you know, it was during the summer, and maybe they were in sundresses and T-shirts and shorts, and they would be yelling at these representatives who would be there in suits and ties. And you didn't even really have to hear the words. All you had to do was see that image, and you knew who was in control and who was not, who had the power and who didn't. And, you know, it's that kind of, and it was such, it was so easily discerned. And I think with Trump and his sort of poorly fitting suits, you know, part of his, that attraction was that, yeah, he was sort of, he was in the suit, so he was a guy with authority. But it wasn't such a polished, well-fitting, you know, boss man kind of suit that people didn't feel that, like, they couldn't relate to him or he couldn't relate to them. And I do think that there are these sort of degrees of polish and degrees of tailoring that do kind of lend this element of hierarchy. And, you know, it's not a monarchy, of course, but, you know, we do have our own sort of way of establishing a hierarchy.
Pat in Rochester wants to know if Robin thinks Donald Trump's ties are too long.
I do. And if I wrote about his ties every single time he wears one and I get emails from people complaining about the length of those ties, I would be in a constant state of tie writing.
Now, if I recall correctly, during John Roberts' confirmation hearings, you kind of wrote a little bit about what the kids were wearing. I think he had some young children, and a lot of people have written about someone like Barron Trump, 10 years old, he's always buttoned up in a suit when he appears on stage with his dad. And I've actually been a little uncomfortable, not necessarily with your work, Robin, but with some of the armchair quarterbacking or this analysis about Barron Trump, that I just feel like at some point you got to leave the kids out of it. But for you in fashion criticism, whether it's Barron Trump or John Roberts' children or Barack and Michelle Obama's daughters, are the kids worth talking about, or should we leave them out of it?
Well, with the Roberts children, it was one of those instances in which, I mean, they clearly had been dressed for the occasion. And so, and I hope that this came through in that piece, I did try to make it clear that what I was looking at were the choices that their parents had made in sort of wanting to create this particular tableau when Justice Roberts was sworn in. With the Obama girls, I mean, I always found it really distressing when there'd be these, you know, particularly fashion publications that wanted to follow, particularly Malia Obama, the oldest daughter, and would try and sort of follow her fashion choices and try to sort of transform her into a fashion icon at the age of, I think, 15 or 16. And, you know, at that point, you know, I think it's part of what the power of fashion is, that when you are that age, it is a way in which you try and sort out who you are. It's something that you use to figure out sort of what social tribe you belong to. You're sorting out your identity. You're trying to figure out who you want to be. And to sort of proclaim someone a fashion icon at that age sort of proclaims them a fully formed human being when they're still far from it. And I thought that was irresponsible.
Robin, I recall having dinner in a New York restaurant, a new restaurant called Pearl and Ash, and it was sort of this hot place. And I remember thinking, my gosh, the people running this place are so much cooler than I will ever be. They're wearing these high-end jeans and T-shirts that look like they were melded onto their bodies. And you know, this is a high-end restaurant, but people are wearing jeans and T-shirts. And then I got to wondering, I wonder what Pete Wells, the restaurant critic for the New York Times, thought about it. And he railed about, you know, the death of the suit and tie in restaurants and, you know, how you can wear jeans to just about any high-end restaurant in the world these days, and there's no penalty for that. And I think he's a bit old-fashioned, that he would like to see it another way. And I thought that was interesting because it's true. There's very few places, you could probably think of a few, but there's very few places you go out to eat and you can't get away with at least wearing decent denim, you know, as opposed to kind of the way we used to dress. We used to dress up to ride airplanes. We don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so in your work, how much do you have to account for changing norms, and how much do you decide, well, I don't like this, I'm going to push back against it, or say, look, these world leaders are dressing X, Y, Z, but the world is changing, and, you know, I sort of take that into account.
Mm-hmm. I would say that, I mean, I do try and take it into account. I mean, I have written about the scourge of leggings being worn as pants because I think that's just, I don't know.
Leggings are not pants?
A sign of the fall of civilization, probably. But I also think that when you start looking at things like jeans and T-shirts, it's also not just a sign that we're becoming a more informal culture, which I think also sort of speaks to a breakdown in terms of sort of etiquette and formality and manners, which we see not just in our clothes, but also in the ways in which we relate to each other. But I also think sort of speaks to the changing nature of how we define dressing up and luxury and wealth. And, you know, the reality is that oftentimes, you know, those jeans are $300 or $400 jeans because there's some esoteric designer, and only if you're in the know do you know that they're that expensive and they're some esoteric designer. So I think multiple things are happening. The changing nature of how we define luxury, it's no longer just, a boucle jacket with gold buttons on it. But it also, I think, is about that the idea of how we engage with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, a designer once said that, you know, dressing well is good manners. It sort of shows that you have an appreciation for an event, that you want to look your best for the people that you're going to be surrounded with, that you care how other people view you, that you care how your appearance might impact their enjoyment at a restaurant or, you know, at the theater. And increasingly, we don't care how what we do impacts other people.
But I have a question there on that, Robin. You said it was a famous designer who made that statement.
So he had a vested interest.
Who is hardly a disinterested party in that.
Which, that's a good point.
Which makes me wonder, as you're writing about these things as well, how much do you have to take into consideration the industry of it and the economic drivers deciding how much to care about this sort of thing?
That, to me, that's one of the most interesting aspects of it. I mean, fashion is this kind of crazy industry that, is producing this wide range of products that, on some level, they are necessities, right? We need to be clothed. We want to wear shoes. We need to wear shoes. But the amount of money that can be spent in pursuit of that is, you know, just ranges incredibly. The only way to really sort of convince people at a certain point, to spend incredible sums of money on something is with sort of this mythology. It's with smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a certain point at which the quality is just not going to get that much better. And so you're selling people on this notion of, this brand reflects who I am. and how I wish to be perceived. You know, and in some ways, it's, you know, it's quite similar to sports. I mean, you can be a fan of any baseball team. It's all the same game. But you make a decision about which team you are affiliated with based on maybe it's family tradition. Maybe it's because you feel that in some way one team better represents your personality and how you wish to be perceived, or it represents, you know, sort of the tribe of people that you grew up with. I mean, I think that fashion and sports have a lot in common, from just the fact that there are these, they're both these sources of incredible enjoyment. One is typically thought of as a more male pursuit, and one is typically thought of as more of a female pursuit. And I think one benefits from that and one suffers for it.
By the way, Eric, I figured out what you should wear tomorrow.
Oh, no.
Wear your $300 jeans. Wear your $300 jeans.
All right, on my to-do list for tonight where I've crossed out tan suit.
Yes. Okay.
$300 jeans.
I'm running out of time and I have to be quick. Kat in Rochester, got to be quick. Go ahead, Kat.
Yeah, I just want to say that I really appreciate this conversation, and ironically had the same exact conversation with a friend of mine from Brooklyn over the weekend. We went to his wedding last summer in Long Island that he insisted that everybody not dress up. And it was kind of like at a public park. He was wearing cargo shorts and flip-flops. I mean, I think his wife was like holding her cell phone the whole time. And, you know, I dressed up a little bit because that's what makes me feel comfortable at a wedding. But we just kind of had this exact conversation over the weekend that he thinks, you know, who cares if you dress up or not at a wedding, a funeral? It's that you came that matters, you know what I mean? So I just want to say that I appreciate this conversation, and I don't know that there's a real PC answer. I think that it's, mm-hmm. it's up to the individual. It's almost the same kind of conversation of what constitutes good music. Well, if you're like a music professor, you probably think that your music is good. So anyways, I just appreciate the conversation, and I'll take your comments.
Yeah, thanks, Kat. Go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there is an answer. I think it's just the realization that it matters. You know, clearly this person didn't want people to dress up because in some way, I'm presuming, you know, he felt that that was not a reflection of who he was, and felt that that would somehow, you know, be in conflict with his enjoyment of the day. So it's, the funny thing to me is that often the people who are most adamant about clothing not mattering are the ones who are most adamant about the kinds of clothing that they will or will not wear.
Hmm. Well, before I go, I have to mention the book here. I feel badly. I've been diving through this book here, and our listeners just wanted to get stuck on Robin's work, which I totally get, for the Washington Post. But her book, her latest book, is The Battle of Versailles, The Night American Fashion Stumbled into the Spotlight and Made History. And I will just say, you don't have to love fashion. You don't have to love fashion to appreciate the storytelling and the research that went into this. A fascinating story from 1973. And Robin, I got about a minute left. Can you just tell our listeners why you wanted to write this story?
Well, it was just a slice of fashion history, sort of a pivotal moment that I think gives people a sense of why the fashion industry exists as it does today, why Paris has a reputation for being sort of the be-all, end-all, why American fashion is much more driven by pragmatism, and just a sense of how interconnected the industry is, just globally.
It's a lot of fun stories. I mean, certainly names that you will recognize, even if you're not as fashion forward as Eric Grody and me. You will notice names, and then you will understand how this sort of pivoted them from, you know, sort of the middle ranks to, you know, big names that we know today, the Bill Blasts of the world. There's so many more. But really interesting stuff in the book is called The Battle of Versailles. Eric Grody, we're going to see you tomorrow night. Tell us one more time.
Yes, 5:30 p.m. at Syracuse University, the Joyce Hergenhan Auditorium at Newhouse. A really quick response to your caller who mentioned the friend in flip-flops.
Yeah.
Louis C.K. just did a big bit on Achilles and Achilles' heel. Flip-flops can get you killed if you're not careful.
Well, some would argue that cargo shorts could get you killed, too. The cargo shorts moment is that, look, I don't want to start war. So I will just say thank you to Robin Gavan, who's been our guest for the hour. Great stuff, and we'll see you tomorrow at Syracuse. Thanks for taking the time for the program, Robin.
Thank you. Looking forward to tomorrow.
She's the author of The Battle of Versailles, the fashion editor for The Washington Post, and the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. Eric Grody, thanks for coming in. We'll talk to you again soon.
Hope for it. Look forward to it.
All right. Short break. More Connections is next.